But right now, he is working on the legs of Nature Boy Ric Flair. Well, just as Flair worked on his legs in Tokyo.
Yes, but this thing here with the legs is true. He's got the legs, but this takes that spine right here below your buttocks and takes that and jars that all the way up to your neckus.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We're going to find out tonight who is the world's heavyweight wrestling champion right here at Super Bowl. Let's get on with it, Daddy.
Super Brawl Saturday? I don't know.
What if he called this, Jimbo?
I think it's a big butt drop.
I think it's a butt bump myself.
There's their double team maneuver.
In mid-air.
Oh, what power.
There has been an escape from Alcatraz. Rowdy Roddy Piper is loose.
Me in the face of Bill doing some heavy clobbering right here at Super Bowl.
Grab your plunder and open the pay window. It's time for Survey Says.
And the t-shirts are too tight too, Billy!
Welcome to a very special edition of Survey Says. Tonight, for our sixth episode, we are going to look back at each and every pay-per-view titled Super Brawl 1 through Revenge. And due to Tim and I's mutual love of fast food, I have a great location for us, Tim. We are live from the drive-thru of the White Castle of Fear.
Very topical selection tonight, and yeah. a popular choice, if I do say so myself. So, again, it's always a mystery to me where we might hail from on these here podcasts. So I am most pleased to be here with you tonight from the White Castle drive-thru. It's always a good time here at Survey Says.
And we also have a very special guest cramped in the drive-thru lane with us in our car. He's in the back seat. He's been quiet for a little bit, but I'm going to introduce him. He's actually could be, in relation to what Eric Bischoff's favorite phrase was, controversy creates cash, because he could be our most controversial guest that we've had yet. He's a longtime friend of Tim and I, going back to the Blog of Doom. It is Travis Banks. Welcome to the show.
Hey, very happy to be here with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
So are you ready to talk Super Brawl?
I'm ready to talk White Castle of Fear and Super Brawl Revenge, which is not to be confused with WCW NWO Revenge.
Or Super Brawl Saturday, I guess.
That as well.
Well, before we actually get into our topic for tonight, we have a little bit of business to take care of. Because, Tim, you have kind of started a thing where we have a Fan of the Month Club joining the ranks of Coco Weaver and James Morgan. We have our third member, and I do not know his name. I hope you do, but he is in charge of a very cool Twitter account, and he's actually listened to a couple episodes of the show. He's shared our posts, and he seems like he's got a very cool Twitter account, because he is in charge of WCW Worldwide.
That's right. And you asked if I had a name. I do not have a name beyond the WCW Worldwide Twitter account. So I guess our third official inductee into the WCW Survey Says Fan of the Month Club is a Twitter handle, but that's quite okay. I don't mind stretching the definition and the qualifications for the WCW Survey Says Fan of the Month Club. And I am shamelessly sucking up here, because I just kind of casually tagged WCW Worldwide in our last post regarding the wonderful theme music of WCW World Championship Wrestling, our last show. And got a retweet from this fellow, from this guy or gal. I don't know,
can
entirely
I,
honest.
For a second, because I can actually make myself useful. I actually know the name of the guy behind the WCW Worldwide Twitter.
No kidding.
He actually lives here in Austin, Texas with myself. His name
He lives with you.
Well,
hey, damn it, well, I was supposed to be your roommate. You're getting that guy instead.
That's a shoot, brother.
It's the CW whore, the new CW whore.
Oh. It's a deep cut. I mean, should we reveal this individual's identity? Is this gonna get heat on us? I mean, I don't want to get dragged on Twitter. That's the last thing I want, because
we could. He actually followed me almost about 3 years ago. What happened is I had gone to a Comic Con here in town, and I tweeted the WCW Worldwide Twitter a picture of a vendor that was selling a bunch of those old WCW Galoob action figures from the 90s. And he had like two or three Craig Pittman action figures. And I just, you know, I tweeted him a picture because I'm like, oh, cool, WCW action figures. He'll enjoy this. And then I started to realize, like, why does this guy have three Craig Pittman action figures for sale? Who is going to buy three Sergeant Craig Pittman action figures? But the WCW Worldwide Twitter followed me back. In addition to the man behind the Twitter, I'm still kind of weary on revealing his name. But, yeah, he lives here in Austin. I know he listens to the local morning show, Dudley and Bob with Matt. And I know he's always interacting with those guys on Twitter, too. So if you want me to reveal his Twitter information, I can. If not, we'll just keep on moving on.
Maybe behind the scenes. We won't reveal that at this point to the listeners, because I feel like WCW Worldwide would like to maintain that anonymity. But I might be interested to know who the real person is behind the account. So Travis, you're already bringing the work rate. I appreciate that that insider knowledge here. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and induct WCW Worldwide into the Survey Says Fan of the Month Club, because they did quite a bit to up our downloads on our last episode. And that was completely unexpected. I just, again, happened to casually tag this individual, this Twitter account, and you know, just promoting our last episode, and got a number of retweets that I really did not expect, which led to kind of an extended dialogue. And certainly they have a great many more followers than I do. Much appreciated, and much respect going out to WCW Worldwide. Check them out on Twitter. Check out the website as well. A lot of great stuff there, some sort of hidden gems, some things you might have forgotten over the years, very much in the vein of what we do on this show. Can't say enough good things for, again, WCW Worldwide. With that bit of business out of the way, we should talk about Travis, should we not?
Yeah.
It's my favorite subject.
Well, on the show, each time we have a guest, we like to do what we did in our first episode, where we kind of reveal what actually brought us to WCW, and then what we liked, maybe what we disliked, if we saw any live shows. So, Travis, when did you become a fan of WCW?
It goes all the way back to the summer of 1998 for me. I was entering the fourth grade, and I don't know if you guys remember going back into elementary school. You know, you'd be away from the summer, and you'd come back for the new school year, and everyone would have kind of like new interests or new hobbies and stuff like that. And, of course, 1998 was the big wrestling boom, the Monday Night Wars. And so everyone came back just talking about, you know, professional wrestling just in general. And there were more, I would say there were more WCW or more kids talking about WCW at the beginning of the school year. And so I kind of tried to hold out for as long as I could. You know, I was being that guy. Just they'd be talking about wrestling, and wrestling, you know, that stuff is fake, right? Not knowing, of course, how it was fake like I do now, but I was one of those guys, and then, of course, I actually turned it on one night. Oh, let me see what all this is about, and, of course, just fell in love. And I actually started out watching WCW a lot more than the WWF. I vaguely recall being very hyped up for Halloween Havoc 1998. That was actually the very first wrestling pay-per-view I saw, period. I did not see it live. I saw it a couple of months later when it was on VHS. I had some friends in my neighborhood, and they would rent a bunch of the wrestling tapes. And so I think I slept over at their house one night, and they had rented two tapes or three tapes, I think. I remember watching Halloween Havoc 98 with them, and then the 99 Royal Rumble. And then we watched two more WWF pay-per-views with them. I can't remember which ones, but I know WrestleMania 14 was one of them. But anyway, so started watching Nitro after that. I cannot remember exactly when I started watching Nitro, but the first three Nitros I remember watching in full. The first one was the one where Bam Bam Bigelow debuted in WCW, and he just tore the roster apart looking for Goldberg. The second one was the one where Ric Flair had the heart attack right before Starcade.
It wasn't a heart attack. Let's set the record straight.
He was poisoned.
Yes.
And then actually going off the heels of that one was the Nitro the night after Starcade 98, where Ric Flair he stripped to his boxers for some reason. And then he ended up fighting Eric Bischoff that night and won control of the presidency of WCW for 90 days. And then, all that other stuff that it was not 90 days. It was a lot longer. And actually, I know, Andy, you mentioned live shows. That was actually one of the things that made me switch over to the WWF side of things, because I'll get more into this when we talk about Super Brawl 9, but there was a string of just horrifically god-awful Nitros in the spring of 99 that were just so bad. I just eventually kept flipping over to Raw more and more until eventually, I think by the end of that school year, so around May 99, I was just watching WWF full-time. And one of the big reasons I switched over to the WWF from WCW was because the week before WrestleMania 15, WWF came to town. And so that was my very first show. It was a house show the week before WrestleMania 15. And just everyone from the WWF was there. You know, it was like Stone Cold, The Rock, Mankind, Undertaker, basically anyone who was on the roster in 99 was there. And it was just so awesome. WCW, though, just never toured. They toured Texas a little bit, looking back through their archives. But they, for whatever reason, they did not come to Austin at all. I think the closest they came was they had a couple of shows in Waco, and I think they had a show in Fort Hood in the early 90s that I've seen on that Graham Cawthon website. And I think they had a couple of Nitros in the Alamo Dome, and that's about it. But of course, being so young at the time, I, in some of those shows, not even knowing what wrestling was, of course, I was not able to convince my parents to drive me to the WCW shows about 2 hours away. So
Now, yeah, in fairness, WCW had a pretty weak house show game, it seems like. We had a couple here in Richmond, Virginia, which I had heard about but weren't heavily promoted. And I have looked at the results, like you said, on Graham's website, historyofwrestling.com, and seems like I wasn't missing out on much. And it's funny, I will say that my experience is really not dissimilar from yours and getting into WCW, where it's like all of a sudden the thing that your friends in school are into, where, you know, you talk about the cyclical nature of professional wrestling, where it was kind of popular, it was kind of cool in the late 80s, early 90s, and then really took a dip and nobody cared about wrestling. Started coming back around in 97. Seems like that's when the WWF was heating up again. But more so just for people, it seemed like, who had been watching wrestling all along, it didn't really begin making inroads, it seemed like, with more of a casual audience, like you mentioned, Travis, until WCW really got big with the NWO angle. And I've, of course, told the story before about how Starcade 97 is really what hooked me. So I got in on the game a little bit earlier than you do, but our experiences are pretty parallel.
So now, Travis, you had mentioned that your first show was right before WrestleMania 15. But wasn't there one that you did go to with your mom a few years ago? You have a story about that one?
Yes, actually, that ties in. So because WCW never toured here, we were just a WWF town, at least in terms of my fandom. I've actually never been able to research if, you know, back in the 80s and the territory days. I know there was Southwest Championship Wrestling down in San Antonio, and then there was also World Class up in Dallas. And I know both held shows in Austin, but I don't know officially what territory Austin officially was. But basically, because WCW, you know, I became such a hardcore fan of wrestling. I was just like, I want to go to, as soon as I got the means and transportation and money to buy tickets to live events, I decided, well, they're pretty fun to go to, even if the overall product is garbage. So I might as well just, you know, go down to San Antonio for a Ring of Honor show, or go see a TNA house show. And that actually brings us to what Andy was discussing. TNA has held 3 house shows here in Austin. They held one in 2008, one in 2011, and one in 2014. And so this one goes back to the house show in 2011, and I'm actually having to pull this up on my old blog because I totally forgot to refresh myself on this story.
I can't believe you've forgotten about it.
I need all the details because this is such a great story. Anyway, TNA came to town. It was the summer of 2011, late July to be exact. And so for those of you listening who have never had the privilege of going to a TNA show, this was during the Hogan era, so they were doing all the VIP stuff. I think if you bought tickets in the first 5 rows or something like that, you got basically VIP access. So you got to go into the arena like an hour and a half early, and you got to attend an autograph session, and you got to, you know, bid for all these exclusive auction items, and all you got to privilege to buy all this special merchandise and other goofy stuff like that. So anyway, what they did is we got to the arena, they let us all the VIP people in, and so Don West is just giving us the spiel, just, oh, here's what we're going to do, here's what you're going to see tonight, hey, why don't you buy some merchandise, blah, blah, blah. So what they did is they had us line up around the guardrail, and all the wrestlers came out of the entrance, and they just basically walked around the guardrail and took pictures with everybody and signed autographs and all of that stuff. And so one of the wrestlers that was doing an autograph signing that night was the Pope, D'Angelo De Niro, I think that was his name. He was Elijah Burke in WWE. And so he was kind of walking around. He was acting really slow, and he came out really late, too, almost toward the end of the autograph session. He was apologizing to everybody, just saying, like, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I was late because I went to Subway before the show, and my breath smells like onions, and I'm so sorry. And I was actually with my mom at this show. I had an extra ticket. No one wanted to take me up on it, so my mom ended up going with me. So he sees my mom.
I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt you, but I would be remiss in not pointing out that I love how you couldn't even give away a ticket to this TNA house show for free. And I'm not like saying that derisively or anything, because this is a WCW podcast. So that would be awfully rich coming from us. But I mean, it's very telling, right?
I agree. I was at the time, I knew a bunch of fans of the UFC, and so I figured, oh, wrestling UFC, and I tried to even tell them, like, oh, Sting and Hulk Hogan are going to be there, and they were just like, yeah, no. So
they told you to stick it in your stinger pipe and smoke it.
Pretty much, yeah. So what was it? No, my mom had been with me to a Raw the year before. It was actually the Raw where Dolph Ziggler had a promo against John Cena, and Vicky Guerrero was out there, and the crowd was so loud that Vicky Guerrero couldn't even talk. And my mom just loved that segment, specifically because there was a guy behind us screaming at Vicky Guerrero, "You're an old hag!" So my mom was just like, I want to go. I want to see all the freaks that are going to be at this show. So Go to this autograph signing. And so the Pope.
Moms can always be counted on for that, right?
It gets even better. So Elijah Burke is out there, and he's apologizing for A, running late. He was saying he was at Subway, and the sandwich guy at Subway took forever to make his sub. And he said to my mom, "I'm sorry, my breath smells like onions." And, you know, my mom does the whole type laugh. And I ask if he had – that was the time when they were doing the $5 footlongs. So I asked him if he had a $5 footlong because, you know, it's TNA, whatever. And he said no, it was actually a dollar more because he had to add on the double meat and all the double veggies and all that stuff. And he ended up paying like $12 for his footlong or something like that. And so my mom is still kind of chuckling at that line about his breath. And so there are a couple other women in the area. And so he looks at all of them and he's just like, you know, I have to have my sub sandwiches just like I like my women, and that's extra meaty. And so, of course, everyone in the area is just cracking up at this point. He's still signing autographs, and my mom is just busting a gut because she thinks that's the funniest thing she's ever heard. And so the Pope comes back to her. He goes, "This one is still laughing because she knows she's going to go home and think about the Pope all night long." And thus was born the story of Elijah Burke hitting on my mom.
Of course. Which it sounds like she didn't have too much of a problem with.
We were actually talking about that the other day. I had dinner with my family, and because I'm going to the Royal Rumble next week, and one of my buddies is flying into town. And so my mom was like, maybe I should come along, see if any of the wrestlers want to hit on me, blah, blah, blah. And my dad was just like, that bullshit story never happened. it's like a gag between my family now, because my dad doesn't believe it actually happened. And my mom is just kind of like not admitting that she's a ring rat, but I get
You said it, not us.
I guess if she were backstage, she's not going to listen to this thing anyway. So,
of course, right? No, but yeah, I've always loved that story. I have to say, it's one of the things that I most associate with you when I think back to some of the glory days of stories back on the old Cruise World Order of RSPWFA2.net. But yeah, we weren't going to let you get out alive without telling that story for sure.
And Andy even told me, I don't know, it happened so long ago, with the death of the CWO, I just haven't thought about it in a while, and I meant to go refresh myself on the story so I could tell it a lot better, but I think we got the point across.
Yeah, those were the good old days.
We should get right into it here. We are talking all of the Super Brawls, are we not? We've done this once before. There is a precedent for this. On our very second episode, Andy and I ran through all of the Starcades, and that was quite the audacious, ambitious task that we set out for ourselves. We did not have a guest on that occasion. We do for this one. So while we have fewer overall shows to go through, we do have one extra hand in the booth here. So this could be an interesting, enlightening experience, and I am definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, Tim, I just thought we would start in order with the first one and go in succession like that. But before we get started, so with Travis, I actually kind of talked you into doing this. Maybe I forced you to end up watching all of these. So had you actually watched the first Super Brawl before, prior to this?
This was my first time ever watching the first four Super Brawls. I watched 5 and 6 a couple of years ago when the WWE Network first came out. I am still doing the chronological watch of the Monday Night Wars. And so once I hit that point in 95 and 96, I watched those two shows. And then 97, 98, and 99, I had seen before on videotape, I think. 2000 and 2001, I'd seen maybe about like 10 years ago via illegal means, you know, like YouTube and torrenting. So,
ditto for me, pretty much. I had not seen much, if anything, from the first, I would say, four Super Brawls prior to this episode. And that maybe I had seen a match here and there, but certainly had never sat down to watch the entire show. 97, 98, and thereabouts, I had seen in somewhat recent years. 95, I watched. I don't remember what motivated me to watch that show, because why would you, as we'll get into, shortly after the network launched. But those first four shows were kind of a blank slate for me going into this. What about you, Andy?
I had seen, actually, thanks to Kurt Kilberg, our good friend, I acquired...
Your contractually obligated shout-out that you've just gotten in.
Yes. Well, I acquired copies of 2, 3, and 4, so I had actually seen those before. I had not seen the first one. I think I also got a copy of Super Brawl 6 from him, but then ones I'd already seen was maybe like the mid-90s ones I'd already watched. But, yeah, so I had seen like a bulk of them before we actually sat down and like started watching these on the network.
All right, Super Brawl 1 took place actually on May 19th, 1991, Bayfront Arena in St. Petersburg. This was a May pay-per-view, which is not the normal time frame that we think of with WCW Super Brawl. It would more traditionally become a February pay-per-view. I did not realize this coming into the show. I always thought that Super Brawl was just kind of a play on Super Bowl, especially with the timing of the event and the, you know, Roman numerals that they used. But this took place in May, and it's kind of funny how they seem to go, seemed like they jumped through some hoops to try to justify why they were having a May pay-per-view. That would become just more of an arbitrary thing over the years, where it's just we have a pay-per-view every single month. But of course, back in the early 90s, this going back to 1991, pay-per-views were kind of few and far between. So they sort of built on the controversy, right, surrounding the finish of the Flair Fujinami match from the WCW NJPW Tokyo Dome show, where that had a somewhat controversial finish. So they have to settle the matter now, determine who is the rightful title holder here, hence this pay-per-view, is what I took away from this. I don't know, Travis. What do you think? What did you take away from this first show?
I would say it's notable mainly for all horrible reasons. It was it was not a good show at all. It wasn't, I mean, it was a bad show, don't get me wrong, but it was one of those shows that, I mean, it's 1991 WCW. You know it's going to be bad. It knows it's going to be bad. It's one of those that you watch and you're not disgusted with yourself after you watch it. You're getting laughs along the ride. You're just like, mm-hmm. I didn't waste 3 hours watching this show, because at least there was some sort of entertainment.
That's the way I felt, because you guys have said it's kind of a bad show, but I actually liked it a lot more than I thought I would, even more than how, like, I think Starrcade 90 we kind of said was like a jokey, like, hilariously bad show.
Yes,
this one,
that is not a real wrestling show by any means whatsoever.
This one kind of felt like that, but it still had like the actual wrestling on it, so it kind of was like a good mix. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was funny, but it had action, and so I enjoyed it.
I felt the same way. It was bad, but in a very entertaining sort of way. I mean, you've got stuff like you know, your opener on this show is the Freebirds, the Michael Hayes, Jimmy Garvin version of the Freebirds versus the Young Pistols, who are the repackaged Southern boys, right? And Brad Armstrong interferes twice in this match on behalf of both teams. So first, he runs in as Brad Armstrong to help the Young Pistols, and because that's Tracy Smothers and his brother. Oh shit! Here we go. Was it Scott or Steve Armstrong in the Young Pistols? Does anyone know or care?
I think it was Steve, because isn't Scott's like the one that's like the referee now? I think.
Brian.
Yeah, that's right.
So it wasn't him.
Yeah.
That's all I know.
In any case, let's not belabor that point, but one of the Armstrongs, right? Either Scott or Steve. So Brad runs in to help them. And then later in the match, we get the debut of Fantasia, the masked Fantasia, who would later become Bad Street, which was Brad Armstrong under a mask and the Freebirds. And of course he gives the Freebirds the assist and helps them win, but this is like never acknowledged and never goes anywhere, which is really funny because they could have actually built something off of this, but they didn't. So that's kind of hilarious to me. I will say that I hated the Freebirds I've kind of always hated the Freebirds, to be entirely honest, which, being someone from the South might be a little bit blasphemous, but what can I say? I like what I like, and I don't like this. But they're a little bit more tolerable with DDP here. We get an early Diamond Dallas Page appearance, do we not?
Yeah, that's what I actually wanted to say, is because I think DDP, he comes out twice, and during one of the times where he comes out, you hear someone talking, but you don't see who it is. And I think he's like waiting for his cue, and he's like, hey, are we ready? And then all of a sudden he starts talking, and I'm like, holy shit. He's got like the little headset thing on, and then he's like, good God.
Right.
There's actually a reason for that. I've been reading some of the old issues of the Wrestling Observer newsletter as I've watched these shows, and the main guy who directed all of the WCW shows, Craig Leathers, he was actually not at this Super Brawl. I think his wife was giving birth. So it was just basically the backup crew producing the show. And as a result, all the timing miscues were off.
Oh, man.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's funny. I kind of wondered if that was deliberate or if that was just a little flourish to DDP's early character in WCW, because the thing that stands out is that he was a surprisingly good talker back then and character. You know, later in the show, he brings out Scott Hall debuting as the Diamond Stud, which wasn't a terrific gimmick, but I don't know. I feel like DDP is a little bit underrated and overlooked as a manager during this time period. He sort of kept up his end of the bargain more than you would probably expect of him. There's also, speaking of debuts, an extremely notable first appearance from one Kevin Nash. What did we have going on here with Kevin Nash at the first Super Brawl?
Well, I had never known what show this came from, but like years ago, you know, everybody has heard of like Russell Crap. And so I knew about Oz from that, but I never knew like what show it was on or when it actually occurred. And so I saw on Wikipedia, I saw it had Oz. And I was like, oh my God, this is the Oz appearance where he comes out. And yeah, it's like they do this really wild, weird thing where they have like the Wizard of Oz characters.
Can I just say real quick that I was laughing so hard at that part, because the set for this show was that weird, crooked WCW logo that they had for like every single show. And so at some point they put a painting of the castle of the Wizard of Oz in front of the set. And that's where all the Wizard of Oz characters are walking up. but it's just such a crappy painting. Like, it looks like something you'd see in a middle school play.
Right, yeah. The production quality and the just the set design here leaves a lot to be desired. I mean, they put, I don't want to say a lot of effort into this, but certainly it consumed a lot of focus on the show. You've got, I guess it's Kevin Sullivan, right? Who is shilling this new character Oz. He's just screeching over and over, "Welcome to Oz, welcome to Oz, welcome to Oz."
And he's also, he's carrying a monkey.
Yes.
I actually read a story not too long ago. I don't know how true this is. I haven't seen anything about it in the Observer, but apparently the monkey was like just running all over Sullivan, like attached itself to his leg or something. So Sullivan at one point gets in the ring. He shakes his leg to try to get the monkey off, and just in a freak accident, like breaks the monkey's neck or something.
Oh, God.
The monkey.
So that's it, huh?
Again, I don't know how true that story is, but it's just something that got a laugh because I read it in such proximity to watching this show.
It's like the live cobra biting Randy Savage that died later, according to legend. So, but yeah, it's a live monkey on a leash. And to be fair, it was jumping all over the place. And it was like, I mean, this seems very ill thought out, to say the least here.
Oh, well, to talk about animals on this pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah.
Big Josh came out there with those bears. That was like,
yes,
so bizarre.
And Jim Ross is just like, "Here comes Big Josh and a couple of his buddies."
Well, he also says, Big Josh and his dancing bears. And he says something that I wasn't quite sure how to take. He goes, And Gary Michael Capetta is out here to announce the proceedings here. He likes bears, does he not, Dust? And I'm like, you know, Jim Ross kind of does this thing where he'll make these like double entendres, but I don't know how woke to like gay subculture fetish lifestyles Jim Ross would have been in 1991, but it is fairly in line with the types of things he would say in the late 90s, such as, "Here's Patterson jerking so-and-so off the top rope," with this whole, and I, you know, I have no idea what Gary Michael Capetta's personal life is like, but he certainly suggests somewhat strongly here that Gary Michael Capetta has some kind of preference for bears. And this is just the point in the show where it like slips into a complete fever dream acid trip for me, because these Big Josh comes out with his, again, we have live animals, bears, actual bears, like collared, muzzled on a leash, walking out on their hind legs. And it sort of slides into that uncanny valley where for a second I was like questioning, okay, are these really bears? Because this looks so creepy, and I need a little bit of convincing before I will buy into the fact that these are actual bears that they have in this arena that he's walking out with. And sure enough, they are, but it was just very unnerving. I don't know if you guys had that same experience, but seeing these bears walk out on their hind legs was just sort of messing with my mind. And then that goes into Paulie Dangerously's interview with Stan Hansen, where he's chewing the tobacco, and that's really like stomach churning in a bad way, right on into the Oz debut. And I'm just like, what is going on with this show, and why am I like feeling I don't know, a little bit triggered right now. This is messed up.
Go back to Oz, I really want to talk about this because
yeah,
even though it was like a really poor conceived character and then like how you said it's just a really bad painting and everything, the actual match itself, that might be my favorite squash match I have ever seen because Kevin Nash, he just picks the guy up and like flings him around and then that's all it is. It's kind of like when Brock Lesnar showed up in like, you know, 2002 and he just, I think, flung around Spike Dudley. It was kind of the same thing. I was like, holy shit, this is awesome.
Yeah, that guy was Tim Parker, evidently, the jobber here. And I did wonder if he was one of the munchkins from Oz, just based on his stature in this match. Because, he gets absolutely annihilated by Kevin Nash / Oz, who picks him up into like a helicopter spin and then drops him into sort of a power bomb. But I guess it gets him over in the way that they intended. I should probably mention that as legend holds, the green fog that sort of permeated the arena as Oz came out and made his grand debut was supposedly sulfur-based, which meant that this entire arena would have smelled like farts for like probably the rest of the show after this. And I mean the crowd is audibly shitting on this whole thing as it's happening, because what do? You've got these glorified extras standing in for Dorothy, Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Cowardly Lion, because I gather Turner Network television stations have now acquired the rights to the Wizard of Oz and they're going for some kind of corporate synergy thing here. And it's just like, this just screams bad idea. Like, why would you invest so much money into this? Why would you think this is going to draw? It's just like no one really sat down to think this thing through. They just threw money at it and said, yeah, it'll be really spectacular and people will be talking about it and we'll just do this whole big production number. But it's like, where do you go from here? How do you build off of this? You're not going to do this giant entrance for every single Oz appearance that is going to take place after this. So what's the point? What's the end game? It's just, it's one of those OMG moments, right, for WCW that we hear about so much, but all in good fun, I suppose.
So, Travis, is there anything else that you thought was either a high or a low from the pay-per-view?
I was actually going to mention earlier that was not the only debut, but before I get into that, I wanted to touch on another Jim Ross, where during the debut of the Diamond Stud, at the very end of that segment, Ross is just kind of like, well, that was quite a debut. All right, let's go back to Gary Michael Capetta. And just he just sounded so unenthusiastic about the Diamond Stud. And I got a laugh out of that. But the other debut that I wanted to bring up was that of Mark Marrow as Johnny B. Bad. And this was, I don't know how it kind of ties back into Jim Ross's quip about Gary Michael Capetta and the Bears, but Johnny B. Bad here is, he hits every stereotypical homosexual thing. And, you know, he's walking out there, he's got pink tights, he's got the limp wrist. I noted on my notes that he's got so much makeup on his face that his face is a different color than the rest of his body. And
he's very made up, which is something that if you're used to seeing Mark Marrow, when he comes out doing this riff on Little Richard, ostensibly, which I don't know, I guess they if that's what they're going for, then congratulations, you pulled it off. But why would you do that? There's a lot of things going on here. Not to your point, the overt, somewhat sexualized nature of this character. You wonder how much of that is just professional wrestling being professional wrestling, or are you just trying to, really commit to the gimmick of this is Little Richard, and well, he was somewhat of a flamboyant performer, and maybe a little bit sexually ambiguous. Sure, no problem, cool. But Little Richard is also a black man, and Mark Mero is not. And we would see this kind of like race bending stuff in WCW, not just with the Johnny B. Bad character, but with PN News as well, who would be described probably in 2017 terms as problematic, to say the least. I think as a character, Johnny B. Bad, looking back again through this 20-year plus lens just about here, is not as bad as something like Goldust later on, which is sort of my measuring stick for how offensive is a ostensibly gay character in professional wrestling, at least at first. Talking about the early Goldust work, but at the same time, it's just a very gay baiting type of gimmick where he's supposed to get heat and you're not really, and this is his debut. So it's like, is he a heel or a face? And this is coming at a time when they're debuting a lot of new characters and just experimenting with, I guess, their formula, because WCW/NWA was not known for this kind of thing, traditionally speaking. But it's sort of like, what do you make of this, and where do you go from here? Can't say personally I'm that offended by it, but it is sort of like, you know, you're not doing the most cutting edge, nuanced thing here. So it just again goes back to that same question with Oz. Are you really expecting this to get over, and is this going to make you money, or are you just fucking around?
Well, I think the Johnny B. Bad character worked out later. They kind of tweaked it over the next year or so, and in 93 he was kind of the way he would be for, you know, 93 94 95 into 96 before he became the Wild Man.
Right, sure. And it should be said that, oh boy, early Mark Mero, I mean, he was incredibly green as of his debut here in 1991. I mean, he didn't have a lot of experience in wrestling, and I don't know exactly how he got hired by WCW to compete on a national stage, but he is ungodly awful at this point. I mean, his matches are pretty unwatchable. He does like a diving sunset flip off the top rope where he almost kills himself every single time he does it, it seems like to me. He would not become what I would think of as even a decent, competent wrestler until about 1994. It's going to be a while, and we're going to suffer through a lot of Johnny B. Bad matches, to say nothing of the character, for a few years here before, Mark Mero is really deserving of the respect, such as it is, that he will amass later on.
Well, anyone else have any thoughts on this first show, or should we move on to the second one?
I guess we should say something about the Sting and Luger versus Steiner's tag team title match, which gets a lot of love in online circles. I'll just say I thought the match was pretty enjoyable, but seems overrated, at least today. It must have been outstanding in terms of, you know, 1991 North American work rate, such as it is. It didn't really live up to the hype for me. I don't know what your individual experiences were with that one.
Travis?
I mean, it was the best part of the show by far. And yeah, it was a good match. I don't know if I would go the full 4.5 stars that most people go, you know, maybe like 3.75 stars, maybe 4 stars, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really do star ratings on this show, but it's one of those things where, I don't know, I feel like if I had to do star ratings, I'm always a little bit lower than the consensus, it seems like, on what are regarded as the really good, like, all-time classic matches, and I'm maybe a little bit higher on things that internet IWC pundits have maybe discarded. So yeah, I'm sort of there with you on that. The main event is, of course, Flair versus Fujinami for, I guess, the undisputed world championship, essentially. So what happened was, at, again, the NJPW WCW Super Show back in, I think, February, they had their first match, and Fujinami won, but in the course of the match, Flair was knocked over the top rope, which in WCW rules would normally result in a disqualification. Therefore, Flair was still recognized as the WCW World Heavyweight Champion, even though Fujinami got the pin and I guess won the NWA championship, even though both titles were just represented by the one belt, which Flair held on to. So this was kind of a way of WCW's saving face and provided a justification for Flair coming out with the title, which would have been just the WCW World Heavyweight Championship, even though there had never really been any distinction between the WCW and the NWA championships prior to this. And this here is going to unite both titles, right? I don't know, Andy, I described it to you as sort of the, like, most boring good match I've ever seen, where it's perfectly fine. Usual stuff you want to see from a Flair main event, but it's awfully heatless and kind of just blah.
Or I'd go with my old word, meh.
Meh, yeah, another good word for it.
I was kind of bored, except for, like, the part where I really love this quote, and I was texting a bunch of people, but, like, Dusty says something to describe some hold as it stretches you from your butt kiss all the way up to your neck.
Yes. Your butt kiss to your neck kiss. Classic Dust, which the announce team we should mention for this show was Jim Ross and Dusty Rhodes, which quite a combination, was it not?
It was almost like Dusty would say stuff like that, and then Jim Ross would, like, no-sell it, and there'd be silence.
Yeah,
and
and that's something else we will observe as we proceed through these shows. I don't know. Travis, you got anything for this match?
I really can't add anything to what you guys said. I mean, my problem with a lot of these Japanese guys that WCW would bring in, especially later on in the 90s, is that they just kind of throw these guys out there. I mean, you've got, like, there was a Nitro I watched a couple of months ago where Masahiro Chono and the Great Muta wrestle each other. But they're just, like, in a random undercard match on Nitro. Like, and Tony Schiavone's just kind of explaining it like, well, they're, you know, big superstars in Japan. And WCW really gave you no reason to care about these guys. So, it, you know, to me, I mean, I know who Tatsumi Fujinami is now. But just watching it as a regular fan, I was just kind of like, you know, I know who Ric Flair is, but I don't know why I should care about this other guy. So,
yeah,
yippee.
It's like, what's the big deal? I mean, the only other notable match from this show was like the explosion of doom, right, with Butch Reed versus Ron Simmons in a cage, which it's better than I expected, at least.
I kind of didn't like it. I would say it was kind of like really like dull because I think it was like Butch Reed just was like beating the crap out of him, but it was really kind of, I don't know.
Here's the thing. What I've seen of singles wrestler Butch Reed is quite possibly worse than Dino Bravo as like the all-time shittiest, most worthless wrestler on the planet. So that was my baseline going into this match. So it's an awfully low bar to exceed. So I mean, I thought it was fine, but I can definitely see you thinking it's just plotting and dull, because I mean it was, but considering the bar they had to clear, it was just so extraordinarily low for me going into this that I was okay with it, I suppose. We should probably mention Missy Hyatt, who she is. They make a big thing of her going into the locker room to get great interviews and scoops, right? They do a poll, I guess, where do people want to see her go into the locker room again, which the last time she did that, it did not end too well for her, because she had a run-in with Stan Hansen, who he treated her bad, right? That was her excuse or her line. And the fans voted, and she's going to go back into the locker room. And she very specifically and pointedly wants to interview Tom Zink in the locker room post-shower, preferably. And that does not happen. She has another unfortunate run-in with Stan Hansen, who honestly, this whole thing was like more offensive than anything related to Johnny B. Badd or JR's off-color references.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, because it's kind of like really like sexist. Like they just kind of put her out there to
really
make fun of her.
So he like spanks her and runs. I mean, it's just, was this a thing in the early 90s of like women trying to get interviews in men's locker rooms and being held to like this double standard or something, and sexism running? I mean, what, it just seems like there was some kind of basis for this that, or some kind of context to it that I was not getting. Again, in the year that we're living in now, where it's, I mean, was this trying to play off of something in actual real sports, or am I just trying to give this more credit than it really deserves?
There was, I recall reading a controversy, quote unquote, maybe a year or two before, and yeah, it involved the NFL, and it was around the time where you started to see the female reporters for the first time, and There was, you know, there was a big deal about, oh, should the female reporters just be able to barge into the locker room where, you know, all the football players are showering after they played a game just so she can get their thoughts for television. And it had something to do with that. I forgot to read up on that before the show, and I'm not going.
No,
to.
I mean, that's my kind of vague recollection. If they were trying to connect it to anything topical at the time as well, but it's just, it's so badly handled. And I mean, it's Missy Hyatt. So what can you say really? But, I don't know. That's just something I thought was worth pointing out because, again, she will be a presence on a few of these shows as we continue. So does that about wrap up the first Super Brawl? I mean, maybe more airtime than it perhaps deserves. But, again, it's the inaugural edition, right? So we have to give it some recognition and some love.
So, Travis, Super Brawl 2, now, is there anything that really stood out to you from this card?
This was actually a really, really fun show to watch. There wasn't anything, like, truly bad. I guess the most famous match from this show would be the opener, which was Brian Pillman defeating Jushin Thunder Liger for the WCW Light Heavyweight title. And that was a match that I felt like I was watching something from this year in terms of just they were hitting all the moves. They were doing a lot of high flying aerial maneuvers, but they weren't, you know, doing all of the 650 flips. You know, it was just kind of like, oh, I'm going to just dive off the top rope outside of the ring and hit you, you know, throw you into the barricade, suicide dive type of stuff.
Very psychologically driven. It wasn't just a lot of high spots for the sake of high spots. I will say I'm a little bit lower on that match than most people, but I would agree that it you can definitely hold that up to anything that you would see today. It certainly still is a pretty respectable match, and considering the time period, 1992, you know, I could see people jumping all over this as like a match of the year type contender, especially again for North American wrestling. This is the Kip Allen Fry era of WCW. Pretty short lived. Few months was he in charge, but I guess he instituted that bonus system where the participants who sort of had the match of the night would receive a commission on top of whatever they would normally earn for their appearance on a live event. So you have guys actively trying to outdo one another. And right out of the gate here, you have Pillman and Liger pretty much winning that bonus, you know, quite handily. Overall, this show, I mean, it's definitely one of the better early WCW pay-per-views, but as is often the case with me and looking back on these things, I'm a little bit lower than most people. Some other things that stand out, you had a really good brawl with Cactus Jack versus Ron Simmons, which again, it's just sort of a mid-card throwaway match, but Cactus takes some sick bumps as he was wont to do, including like a spine buster on the ramp. You know, Simmons wins, catching him with like a power slam, Jack coming off the top rope. Just both guys look really good.
I have to add on to that because with Super Brawl 2, the copy that I had on DVD was the home video version. So it clipped it down to like five matches, I think just the title matches. And so it was a really easy watch to watch it on like DVD. I didn't actually spend any time to rewatch those, but I watched the earlier matches on the show that were actually on the pay-per-view that I hadn't seen before. So yeah, the Cactus Jack, Ron Simmons one, I really like that one. But talking about really weird like racial comments from the previous show, during this match, like Jesse Ventura, he points out Junkyard Dog, and he's like, what? He's wearing a white tux. He looks like a waiter up there. or something.
Oh,
it was just
really
random. And it kind of was like, it was funny, but then I'm like, should I be laughing at that? Because it sounds really
it's
racist.
A little fucked up, right?
Yeah.
But, we should mention, this is Jesse's first show.
Yeah.
And he calls it with Jim Ross. They aren't the best pairing, I will say, because Jesse is being Jesse, his sort of typical leaning towards favoring the heel's self, but kind of telling it like it is. But JR really doesn't want to play ball here. I mean, JR is strictly like a play-by-play guy, and you can tell that Jesse is kind of poking him and trying to prod him, and JR is just not having it. So you'll have these sequences where Jesse is trying to set something up, just kind of a repartee between them, potentially, you know, would do with Gorilla, but Jim Ross would completely no-sell it. You know, calling back to that first show, like you mentioned. And you'd kind of get this awkward silence between them. And it was like, they just weren't clicking. And in a way, it kind of works. It's kind of funny just having JR play that straight man. But at the same time, you do want something a little bit more out of your commentary on a professional wrestling show. So I don't know if either of you picked up on that, but I just thought, wow, this is like a clash of personalities here.
I did actually note it was during the Dustin Rhodes and Barry Windham versus Steve Austin and Larry Zbysko match that I think it was towards the beginning of the match, Jesse Medusa's accompanying one of the teams. And Jesse Ventura says, and I quote, "Medusa looks like she's been in the gym. Her chest looks really good tonight." And Jim Ross just, you know, disgusted JR, just, yeah, whole lot of bench pressing, I'm sure.
Right. He just tries to turn it into something it isn't. Good example of that for sure. You know, that match, it's a match with three guys I really like, plus Larry Zbysko. And here again, it's something else that's held in pretty high esteem where I kind of just don't see it. Austin was about a year away from becoming like pretty good in the ring. Like he's kind of green at this point in 1992. So even though this is really the peak of the Dangerous Alliance angle, I didn't get a lot out of this match. I felt like it was below the level of what everyone in it was really capable of. And again, I think I'm a minority in that opinion because a lot of people just awfully love this match, but I'm like, what's the big deal here? It's fine, but it didn't blow me away.
Maybe I'm just
am I missing something?
Maybe I'm just a big mark for Barry Windham and Dustin Rhodes as a tag team, because I've talked about that before on other shows, I think.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I really do like Dustin and Windham as a tag team. I really like Austin, of course. So even discounting Austin, who wasn't quite there yet as a performer, and just discounting Larry Zbysko, who I don't particularly care for, I am a mark for Windham and Dustin, but I don't know. I wanted to like this more than I did. And, you know, it was perfectly decent. And then it just has this sort of abrupt finish. And I'm like, oh, that's it. Like, Windham or Dustin, I can't even remember who it was. It's like a clothesline off the top rope on somebody, and that's it. I'm like, But again, you got to put yourself in that mindset of it's 1992. This is kind of how a lot of finishes were. You aren't going to see the spectacular, you know, false finishes on both sides type of deal, and it's got to end in a finisher sort of thing, because that really wasn't the mentality back then. Kind of similar story with the Steiners versus Anderson and Eaton. Again, we've got the Dangerous Alliance here. but a sort of disjointed match with a disappointing fuck finish, kind of a dusty finish, where they reverse the decision after you think the Steiners have gone over. Not really a typical Steiners match for this time period. Did you guys take anything else away from that match?
I felt the same way about this tag match that you felt about the Rhodes and Wyndham tag match, actually. It was a really fast-paced match. There was a lot of energy, particularly from the Steiner brothers. But, you know, for me, Bobby Eaton is one of those guys where by the time I started watching wrestling, he was, I think he was completely done as a performer. And I've just never had that same enchantment with him that a lot of other older wrestling fans do. And so, again, it was just a good match, but you mentioned it was a crappy finish. And those bad finishes will, you know, it could be a five-star match, but if the finish is awful, I'll hate it. I'll drop it down to, you know, however many stars I think it deserves, but...
Yeah, I mean, you can be really into a match and you're like, okay, if it ends right now, I would consider this a great match. But if that finish just so detracts from what you've seen up to that point, it's just like you're done with it.
Back around to Bobby Eaton.
Yeah.
You know how I said on the first show that one thing I liked about WCW is that they were kind of a place for Bobby Eaton? It was like WCW was actually like a place where they could push Bobby Eaton, whereas like WWF, you know, yeah, like, I don't know, he didn't have the look. Well, a few weeks ago, I went to an independent wrestling show about an hour north of here. I went with my buddy and his girlfriend and his daughter and this other guy that I didn't know. He like rode along because he had an extra ticket, and his name was Brian. Well, on the way back after the show, everybody in the backseat of my car was kind of tired, so I was trying to talk to this Brian and ask him about his fandom with the wrestling, and he was saying that a few years ago he went to some indie shows in Tim's favorite Illinois town of Pekin, Illinois, and and Bobby Eaton, he actually
the
was kind
dumbest
of
dumbest name town in America.
he actually was kind of like the main event, kind of like a like star that they would kind of bring in as like an attraction maybe. And he said Bobby Eaton was signing autographs, and he was like totally like almost like passed out drunk and was signing people's names wrong. And at one point this guy Brian was gonna go to the bathroom. He walks in there, Bobby Eaton's on the toilet crapping and didn't like shut the door. He didn't shut the stall door. So I'm like, oh my God. Like everything I thought about Bobby Eaton being cool, I'm like, maybe yeah, that's why he didn't get a job in WWF.
No, just like this is super unfortunate because Bobby Eaton has like a reputation as being one of the very nicest guys in the entire professional wrestling industry. And like in recent years, I guess he's fallen on hard times. There was a thing like about a year or two ago about him going missing, and then he was found at like an airport or something. So my takeaway was that maybe he is suffering from maybe a form of dementia. I mean, I don't really want to speculate, but it seems like there's something going on with him. So the notion that he is still competing in wrestling matches or making wrestling appearances is a little bit troublesome. So, yeah, that's kind of messed up, but what a story. God, oh. And it's funny that he's teaming with Arn Anderson here, because they had a singles match for the TV title at the first Super Brawl, which Eaton won. And it was like, hey, way to go, Bobby Eaton. He's like a great singles wrestler now and won a title. And that ended quite abruptly, and now he's a heel teaming with Anderson, even though he was pretty over as a face. So, okay. But, I mean, I kind of liked him in the Dangerous Alliance, and I know that, Andy, you're sort of a low-key Bobby Eaton fan as well. So, all right, good on him.
Anything else to add, guys, for this second Super Brawl?
Yes. Rude versus Steamboat. Decent match, but pretty boring. I guess this is worth it for the whole ninja bodyguard thing that Steamboat had going on, where we would see this ninja who was hanging out outside of Steamboat's locker room. And at one point in the show, here again, Missy Hyatt, trying to get those scoops backstage, tries to interview the ninja, tries to interview Steamboat. The ninja's not having it. Then Medusa comes up and starts jawing with the ninja. He, like, chases her off, and that's the last you see of him until this match. Then he kind of, the ninja inexplicably turns on Ricky Steamboat, hits him with the giant brick mobile phone, which leads to the great Jim Ross call. He's waddling like an old woman. It had to be Paulie Dangerously, which we saw in a slow motion replay. Pretty great. And Missy Hyatt backstage does get her big scoop, where she tries to interview Rick Rude post-match after his victory, sees this ninja unmask, and lo and behold, it is Paulie Dangerously. So I was a little bit confused here as to whether was Paulie the ninja all along, or did they pull like a switcheroo type deal where the ninja was a legit bodyguard for Steamboat, and then after Medusa ran him off, they like replaced it? I didn't know what was going on here. I don't know if that's WCW dropping the ball or just me overthinking it.
Seems like one of those Looney Tunes kind of cartoony plots where, yeah, they ran off around the corner and probably got hit with a frying pan, and then like Paulie Dangerously took his outfit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, the Rude Steamboat match, it's been described as kind of a 70s throwback sort of match in the way that it's worked. It's okay, but doesn't do a lot for me. Travis, you got anything for this?
It's really quick. During the Marcus Bagwell and Terry Taylor match, they had a guest ring announcer named Barry Abrams, and they made a big deal about how he was
from my God, yes, thank you.
So I actually Googled him, and it turns out that Barry Abrams of Syracuse University went on to become a major bigwig producer at ESPN, and he also runs his own voiceover company, so... He's gone on to bigger and greater things, all because of WCW.
Thank you for that, because, wow, yeah, I guess he won some contest where he's going to be the special guest ring announcer, and they show him in the ring with, like, a tuxedo jacket on, which, okay, fair enough. But then they do a wide shot, and you see he's got, like, just boxing shorts on. It's just not a good look, dude. And he gets booed hard by this crowd. I mean they really shit on him. Did he show up dressed like that, or did they do this as a joke? It was really bizarre. I mean, truly, just what are you doing? Like, why would you expose yourselves and expose this poor person in that way? So yes, thank you for pointing that out. And wow, I'm fascinated by the later career of young Barry Abrams. Good on him. Awesome. Main event here is Sting versus Luger. It absolutely blows. I maintain that Sting and Luger never had a even decent one-on-one match against each other. Luger is yoked out of his fucking mind here. This is his last match in WCW before he goes on to the World Bodybuilding Federation, right? So he's just juiced to the gills. He blows up pretty much immediately and is pouring sweat in this match. Like, he had no conditioning, no cardio whatsoever. He looks like me after 3 minutes of doing light housework. Just... it's ridiculous.
I don't have anything else to add for this pay-per-view except one like little thing. If anybody listening has ever watched the home video version, which is the one that I saw first, I don't know. I guess WCW must have been really awful at editing these because like I said, they have the five kind of notable matches, like the title matches, and then they do, like, right after the first match, they cut to Terry Taylor, and he's backstage with Missy Hyatt, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to show Marcus Alexander Bagwell, I'm going to teach him a lesson. And then they cut right to the next tag match. So it was, like, a really weird edit.
That is very strange. It sort of seems like there is no rhyme or reason to the way that Turner Home Video edited their releases, which, I mean, some of these pay-per-views seemed like they were lucky to even get a commercial release. So, I don't know what to tell you there. But, yeah, you weren't missing much by having he was the tailor-made man at this point, right? Doing a Ted DiBiase ripoff. This is post-York Foundation, Terry Taylor, with a rookie Marcus Alexander Bagwell, prior to our favorite WCW tag team of Hung and Bung, with Marcus Alexander Bagwell teaming with Two Cold Scorpio.
You always have to throw in the Hung and Bung reference.
I contractually obligated, got to get that reference in as well. Moving right along to Super Brawl 3, right? February 21st, 1993, from Asheville, North Carolina. We have Eric Bischoff and Missy Hyatt opening the show, and they are joined by Johnny B. Badd, who I'm wondering, was he hurt or something? Why wasn't he in a match on the show? I have no idea. But it seems like these first three Super Brawls could sort of be described as the wacky misadventures of Missy Hyatt, because again, we have her in these backstage antics on these shows. The big deal here is Ric Flair's return. So Super Brawl 1 was where he had quite enough of Jim Herd's shit, and shortly thereafter departed for the WWF. And this is where he is making his return to WCW. He won't be wrestling again for a little bit, but he makes his on-screen return, at least at this show. The limo pulling up, Missy Hyatt trying to score the interview. And there was surprisingly little pomp and circumstance, it seems like, surrounding Flair's return. The limo just sort of pulls up. He gets out. There's a bunch of girls, like you would typically associate with Ric Flair, and that's kind of that. They don't try to build intrigue into this. It's just a limo pulls up, and there's Flair. So that was, I don't know, my takeaway, that it just seemed like they would try to make this more suspenseful than it really was, unless it was just super obvious that Flair was going to be here, and they just wanted to dispense with all that bullshit. What'd you guys think here with Flair's return?
I was kind of in a bad mood when I watched this show to begin with, and I know I really disappointed Andy, because I told him I was watching it, and he was like, oh yeah, White Castle of Fear. And I had seen the entire mini movie. It's on YouTube. And they split it up into just short, like 20-second segments throughout this pay-per-view. And it just comes off really bad. It's nowhere near as entertaining as the full movie. But I just thought everything, pretty much everything on this show was just meh. Like, I'm kind of used to when they do a limousine angle on a wrestling show these days, the limousine pulls up at the beginning of the show, and then they put a camera in front of the limousine for the entire show, and they keep going back and forth from the arena to the limousine, and nothing happens.
Yes.
This time, and like you said, it's kind of anticlimactic, where the limousine pulls up, here comes Ric Flair. They actually have Ric Flair speak. You know, that'd be something that, I don't know, WWE would hold off until the end of the show, or, you know, maybe the next night on Raw or something like that. But he does his trademark woo, and then he runs off, just he's engulfed by security guards. And it's just like, and then he comes out to ringside later. I think it was for the Barry Windham Great Muda match. And It's like, well, he's just Here, he's sitting there, and he's not doing anything.
Yeah, it's weird, right? I mean, you expect more from this than it really is, but I don't know. The show as a whole, like a lot of 1993 WCW pay-per-views, it looks reasonably decent on paper, but kind of doesn't deliver in practice. I will say a real standout here is Chris Benoit versus Too Cold Scorpio, which I thought was crazy good. I'm just going to say, I mean, I have a hard time with, you know, just watching Benoit matches nowadays, but as a just professional wrestling match, I was pretty blown away by that.
Did you say Chris Benoit?
I actually noted that they because I watched this show shortly after I listened to that podcast, and they played that theme for Benoit, but they did it without the bugle. So I noted in my notes that Chris Benoit did not have the Benoit bugle.
No, you will never hear the Benoit bugle in WCW, which that was such a revelation for me on our last show, which, wow, Andy, how did that go again? What was the intro to his theme?
Now, didn't you describe that when you heard that later as like salute your shorts? It sounded like that. Horn.
Yes. It reminded me of the opening to salute your shorts on Nickelodeon with, the intercom, the announcements from Dr. Khan, right, would always be preceded by something like that, or at least the theme song to that show. Something, but no, that is what I think of every time you play that.
Something else to note, didn't you, right after we recorded the show, or no, after it was actually posted online, I think, so it was in a way we could go back and say where we found it from, but you actually told me that you found a song on YouTube where it was a band that was from the 1980s.
Right. Well, you had mentioned that Chris Benoit's entrance music was a song called Replica. And I'm like, what? So I look up this song, and it is an actual song from a band called Blood Brothers. They did a video from this song. I think it was from 1988, 1989, thereabouts. You can find it on YouTube. It is quite something. Apparently, Wade Barrett is their lead singer. I don't know what else to say beyond you really need to check this out. It's another Chris Jericho mammoth situation where the entrance music is a song from a legit recording artist that just sort of turned into a production theme. But wow, what a thing. What a find. I really love this match. That's all that is to say. I really love this match.
Travis, you said that you were kind of maybe in a bad mood with this show, and you didn't like it, but what did you think of the Cactus Jack and Paul Orndorff match? Because watching it again, I really liked that match a lot.
Yeah, that was it was a Falls Count Anywhere match, I believe. I just remember, I think they started fighting out in the set, and it was your typical Cactus Jack match where he's going to do all the bumping, and he did a lot of painful looking bumps on the concrete. I believe he landed on his hip a couple of times, and it just kind of made me cringe because there's all that news going around right now that Mick Foley needs to have the hip replacement surgery. So that was one of those things. But yeah, this was a perfectly fun Falls Count Anywhere brawl.
There was one spot in that match where, like, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but they seem to have, like, two entranceways, and then there's, like, fans in between. Did you pick that up from this pay-per-view? Like, they had, like, two different, like, runways?
I didn't really pick up on that, but this was one of those matches that I've never thought much of Paul Orndorff's WCW run. And then I watched this match and was very pleasantly surprised, just like you said, Andy, where I was just like not thinking it was going to be anything. And it's like Cactus bumping like a madman and Orndorff just looking like a motherfucker, even though at this point, you know, he's pretty well past his prime. But they kind of just worked in a way that you wouldn't expect. So I'm with you, Andy, and thinking quite highly of that match.
I was just going to say the weird entrance runways was because, like, it looked like Paul Orndorff, like, flung Cactus Jack into one set of guardrails. He flipped over it, did almost like a windmill thing, and hit the next guardrail.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
It was, like, nasty, but it looks like something out of a movie where they'd insert, like, the Wilhelm scream. Because I think Cactus Jack even kind of, like, made a, ah, or something when he's getting, like, flung like that. It was, like, so crazy.
Yeah, there were some nutso bumps in this. What else we got? There's Wyndham versus Muto, which is basically Chinlock City. Like I said, match sounds okay on paper, but kind of just sucks in practice. That's where Flair comes in, sort of steals Wyndham's thunder a little bit. But, I mean, it was a pretty nothing match, I thought. But really what everybody shows up for when it comes to this show is the White Castle of Fear strap match, right?
Hell yeah.
Holy shit. It is insanely violent. I mean, even by today's standards, where these guys are bleeding hard way. I mean, I don't think there's any blading going on in this match. They're whipping each other with the strap, and it's not just like broken blood vessels. It's like actual wounds. And I mean, it really made me cringe when Vader just gets whipped over and over and over again, and you see that his chest and his back is actually bleeding from getting whipped with the strap. It's Sting is holding nothing back, and it's like, holy shit. Which this is going back to, I guess, what our third episode where we did that spotlight on Sting, not thinking of him in terms of this like badass hardcore performer, more of just an entertainer, more of a showman. This is where he just lays it all out on the line and he goes for it.
Only thing I can add is Dave Meltzer, he didn't really say much about this show to begin with, because the same issue where he was supposed to review this show, it was the same week that Kerry Von Erich shot himself. And so, obviously, most of the focus of that Observer issue was on that. But he did note that during that White Castle of Fear match, if you recall, Vader got this nasty cut on his left ear, and it almost looked like his ear was ripped off. Apparently, I can't remember if that was from the strap or what, but Vader had a minor artery get cut, and he actually had to go to the ER after this pay-per-view and get, you know, stitches and... He actually did lose a lot of blood. They had to keep him overnight in the hospital, I believe.
Wow. Yeah, I'm not surprised, because his ear was definitely bleeding pretty heavily. I assumed it was from the strap, but yeah, I mean, it was just, this was brutal. I mean, it really was. And, you know, even in defeat, you know, Sting looks pretty good here. I would say this is far and away the best strap match I've ever seen. And I guess I'll go ahead and say, I think my favorite match from any Super Brawl, period. Again, I don't do star ratings really, but this is just an overall just awesome match.
Yeah,
Andy, it's your favorite Sting Vader match, right?
Yeah, and I've already said, I think it's possibly even my favorite WCW match of all time.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I don't blame you. And of course, you've got the backdrop of the White Castle of Fear, one of the great WCW mini movies. It play is.
Play the game. Play the game.
I don't know. So how does this work exactly? It's supposed to be Vader's castle fortress in the Rocky Mountains where he lives, I guess, right? And he has sort of a he's of course got his manager, Harley Race, aka Baby New Year, aka the kid from Bad Santa all grown up. And then he sort of got this harem of women, by which I mean two or three women who appear in the mini movie. And it's weird because the way this is, the way they lead up to this throughout the show is just various little cutaways where it's Sting making his journey to the, White Castle of Fear. And they're just seconds long. It's just these little interstitial things where it's not even minutes at a time that it eats up on the show. It's just seconds where they would cut away and show Sting doing something. He was like, I don't know what I'm getting myself into here. And well, this looks awfully familiar. And then they just kind of lock it up with the straps and the weird mastodon helmet sitting on the table. It's just like, what is this? And they don't show the entire White Castle of Fear mini movie on this show, which is unfortunate because it's, I think, one of the more infamous and better WCW mini movies.
It's kind of like, I thought it's like Jabba's Palace or something from like Return of the Jedi.
That's a great comparison.
It's really hard for me to explain because you mentioned it's in the Rocky Mountains, and it's like they went there in the dead of winter, so there's just snow everywhere, but then it's almost like they would later reuse the set from the White Castle for the Dungeon of Doom set whenever they did that mini movie at that one clash where Hulk Hogan goes into the dungeon. It's not hot, brother.
It's not hot. There are no Hulkamaniacs here.
I've never been here before.
Oh, didn't God. Look familiar to him in the way that it did Sting. So quite the irony there.
And weren't all the women just randomly prancing around in bikinis?
I don't know. I sort of felt like, yes, they were. It sort of felt like the Silk Stockings theme should have been playing over some of this stuff. Which, admittedly, is a Place to Be Nation Vintage Vault staple. But, Andy, if you could get your hands on that, I think it might be appropriate for some of these segments.
Well, if we don't have anything further to add to Super Brawl 3, I think it's about time we take a break on Survey Says and check out all the podcasts available here on the Place to Be Nation. And it's about damn time I get this sack of onion rings from the White Castle.
From the White Castle drive-thru. Very good.
We'll be back here on Survey Says.
Consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines. our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now it will be known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Out of the ruins, out from the wreckage, can't make the same mistake this time.
Survey Says, as we are surveying the Super Brawls, I think we've all enjoyed our White Castle meals, and now we're going to head into Super Brawl 4, which features not one, but two Thunderdome cage matches. Travis, you said you have not seen this show before, but did you like anything from this show?
It was a fun enough 2 hours and 45 minutes. I didn't think anything really stood out, at least in a positive way. I was honestly bored to tears by the Lord Steven Regal versus Arn Anderson match. I think that went to a 30-minute draw or something like that.
Yeah.
I did really enjoy the whole angle with Johnny B. Badd, and he was supposed to wrestle Michael Hayes. But Michael Hayes came out in a wheelchair and said he couldn't wrestle. So Nick Bockwinkel declares that Jimmy Garvin has to take Michael Hayes' place. And I thought that was a fun angle, especially at the end of that Garvin and Bad match where Garvin hits Johnny B. Bad with the Stone Cold Stunner, which they called the 911. And Jimmy Garvin starts running around screaming, 911!
Yes! What was that? So Jimmy Garvin is basically 2 years retired and gets roped into having this match with Johnny B. Badd. It's a perfectly decent little match. And then hits him with the stunner post-match, like he said, calls it the 911. Was he really trying to get over a new finisher, like, as a retired wrestler? What the hell was up with that? I had the same reaction.
I'm not quite sure myself. They didn't really go into too much detail in The Observer. on that one. And I have no idea where this even went as an angle or a storyline, because my knowledge of 1994 WCW is basically, I don't know, I guess from May onwards to the Hulk Hogan debut. I just know the in-ring, actually, I know Ric Flair was the head booker, and the in-ring product before Hogan came in was really, really fantastic. And then Hulk Hogan came in and just kind of started pushing his buddies and got rid of the younger guys. And this show kind of fit in with that description. There were a lot of fun matches. There was that Cactus Jack, Max Payne, Nasty Boys match that I thought it was their famous match, but Andy informed me that was actually the Spring Stampede match. This was a fun precursor to it, though. And the last two events, the double Thunder Cage matches, those were both good, but they were just very rushed, and I think it was a lot of because of that hideously boring Regal and Arn Anderson match. But this was a fun show.
I thought this was an okay show. The narrative, like you said, is that during this pre-Hogan 1994 WCW run, the match quality was really good. I would not hold this show up as an example of that, because just, again, watching it for the first time, this felt like a slog to get through. Not because it was actively bad, but just because I wasn't super invested in any of the matches. It just sort of felt overly long. Like you said, that Arn Regal match is insufferably long. It goes 30 minutes for the TV title. And again, in IWC circles, I know there's a lot of people who have a lot of fondness for that match, and I get it. If you're really into Arn and you're really into Regal and you're into that kind of mat work type of match where it's very focused on a body part, wearing a guy down, yeah, that's your shit. But it is really not my bag at all. And I swear to God, this is the longest undercard match on any North American professional wrestling pay-per-view of all time. It goes 30 minutes. It's ridiculous. The Freebirds, the Garvin Hayes versus Johnny B. Badd thing, to answer your question, Travis, it goes nowhere. I mean, the Freebirds are done after this. They're gone. I think maybe they do some stuff in OVW later. I don't know. But as far as WCW is concerned, they're out of there after this. So it's really weird. I did kind of like Nick Bockwinkle as the commissioner at this point, surprisingly enough. I haven't had a lot of exposure to him, but you know, during the whole thing where Hayes is bitching about how he can't work and he's injured and he really wants to get his hands on Johnny B. Badd, and oh, if there was only something they could do about it. Bockwinkle is like standing there with his hands behind his back. He's just kind of got this wry smile on his face, and it's just sort of funny, and it's crazy to me how much J.J. Dillon will actually channel Bockwinkle when he becomes, what was his title, chairman of the WCW executive committee or the championship committee or something like that in the late 90s. They're very similar in their demeanor, and I guess I never realized that going into the show and seeing Bockwinkle here, who I kind of dug. This is the first Bobby Heenan on commentary, a Super Brawl. I don't know when his first official WCW show was, but this is his first Super Brawl appearance, certainly. Immediately, he has much better chemistry with Tony Schiavone. He's still really on his game in 1994. I know people kind of dog Heenan later on in his WCW run, but at this point, he's pretty great. And really funny. I mean, he legitimately cracks Schiavone up in a lot of segments where on camera, Tony is just losing it. And I definitely got a kick out of that. It's funny to me that there were comments alluding to Hulk Hogan and what Hulk Hogan thought and what Hulk Hogan might have been up to during this time period, even though he has not officially signed with the company yet. That was something I certainly did not anticipate in a February 1994 WCW pay-per-view. So that kind of blew my mind a little bit. I would concur with Travis that the two Thunder Cage matches were a little bit underwhelming. You had the six man with Rude, Austin, and Orndorff versus Sting, Pillman, and Dustin Rhodes. It sort of feels like it ends right about where it feels like it gets going, and Pillman was the only guy who really showed any kind of thunder in this match. Not to coin a phrase there in the Thunder Cage. But Vader, Flair, and their rematch is pretty rushed, just sort of going through the motions. Of course, you've got the boss serving as the special referee. Did he look like a dumbass not having the keys to his own fucking handcuffs when he gets cuffed to the ring? What was that about? I mean, he gets handcuffed to the ring ropes and is struggling to get free. And I'm like, they're his own handcuffs. He should have the key, right? They took the keys to the cage away from him, but presumably they would not be the same keys to his handcuffs. So he just looks like an idiot. What the hell?
I just kept laughing because the boss is wearing his exact same police outfit that he wore in the WWF when he was the big boss man, except changed the colors. He's wearing, you know, he's not wearing the light blue shirt. He's wearing like a dark navy blue shirt. And I think he's wearing black pants, but he's still got the yellow stripe on the sides.
Yeah, that was pretty ridiculous and pretty blatant and not something that I even was cognizant of, I don't think, until I really started watching that early Ray Traylor WCW run where he came in as the boss. I was like, I had the vague sense that he was just doing another big boss man riff, but I didn't think it was that that blatant or that similar, but it really was. I don't know how they thought they were going to get away with that. I really don't.
I have to say, Flair versus Vader, they showed like a pre-packaged thing, and I'd already seen that Clash of the Champions, which was actually Bobby Heenan's first appearance, the January Clash. And they had a match, was a tag team match, where it was Sting and Flair against Vader and Rude. And they do this thing where I think there's a huge like superplex spot, and they show it in the little video package, but they like really hyped it up like this was going to be a huge rematch from Starrcade, and it was. It was a hot match, but I feel like it was just on fast forward. And I even looked online at the time,
right,
and I noted this, that the match, this Thundercage match, was only 10 minutes long, which is half as long as the match at Starrcade. And that's still not even as long as the 30-minute draw. And I'm like, what the fuck? Anytime I see a 30-minute draw on a pay-per-view, I'm just like, I don't even care what happens, and I'm not even going to watch it. So I really didn't even watch the match. I was like, fuck that match, because it's probably like the 30-minute thing from Starrcade, where it was a shitty tag team match, then an even shittier finish. But so they should have just cut that out to the regular 15-minute time limit, given the other 15 minutes to this Flair versus Vader match, because I loved a whole lot of it. The action was like awesome, because you see like Vader get whipped into the turnbuckles, and he actually does the Shawn Michaels thing where he hits the turnbuckles, flips over, lands on the apron. But the thing was, is I think he's kind of fat, so he does it kind of slow, but it was still pretty cool that he actually had the agility to like boost himself over the top rope onto the apron. And then it was so hot where like him and Harley Race are like beating down Flair, and then you got the boss is handcuffed, You got Arn and Steamboat outside, and they're like trying to break in with chairs and bash the door off. It was so hot.
And Arn lets out a very audible shit as he tries to get into the cage.
Yeah, it was so hot. But then the thing is it makes Vader and Harley Race look like completely stupid because they can't take out Flair. And they have the whole advantage, and they still can't even beat Flair. So I really want to love it for what it is. It's a hot 10-minute match, but there is some stuff that's like, oh, my God, man, they make, Vader look like an idiot.
Yeah, I'm kind of there with you in that. I don't really like the fact that Flair goes over Vader twice in a row, essentially. So he gets the big win at Starrcade, right? Fair enough. And this is their rematch, heavily promoted. And you don't really want Flair going over him clean again because of the type of character that Vader is. So they do kind of a screwy finish where Flair gets him in the figure four and the ref just kind of, I guess, counts a submission that Vader never really gave. So they try to preserve a little bit of Vader's heat, but at the same time, he really does come out of this looking like a bit of a chump. And Harley Race managing him was always a little bit dicey for me in that, I don't know, I guess on the one hand I'm used to it, but on the other hand, it's 94-year-old Harley Race managing this total unstoppable monster type character. So you're like, what the hell? But yeah, they kind of look like dumbasses coming out of this thing. I'm with you there for sure. And I'm not sure that Vader ever really recovered when you look at the rest of his 1994 and, you know, his 95 stuff.
Well, I guess we can move along to Super Brawl 5 now, unless anybody has any final thoughts.
I just wanted to point out one thing. This kind of goes back to the last four shows, but Super Brawls 1 through 3 on the credits, they listed, there's an entire section dedicated to assistance to Mr. Virgil Runnels.
What the fuck?
And I the first time I saw it, I just thought that's hilarious that Dusty needs to credit his own assistants. And I actually had a conversation with Andy about this because they, at least for Super Brawl 3, I wrote them all down and they were listed as Jody Hamilton, Bill Dundee, Greg Gagne, Grizzly Smith, Mike Graham, and Janie Engel. And some of those names might sound familiar to any of the listeners. I know Jody Hamilton is Nick Patrick's dad. Bill Dundee was the Sir William guy that was...
Yeah, and a big guy in Memphis wrestling.
Yeah, he's the dad of one of the guys from PG-13, too.
Yes.
And then Grizzly Smith is Jake Roberts' dad. But anyway, those were changed from assistants to Mr. Virgil Runnels to wrestling assistants for Super Brawl 4. And then it's the same guys. And then after this, I think they're just labeled as like, I wrote it down somewhere, but it's just like wrestling, you know, knowledge, I don't know, wrestling teachers or something like that. So I was talking to Andy about it. I thought maybe those are the bookers, like maybe the booking committee.
Yeah, that I was going to say, yeah, maybe they were part of a booking committee because I know that in 93, that was right after Bill Watts ouster for being a total complete piece of shit. And that Super Brawl was booked by committee and it was a ridiculously huge booking committee. I mean, it was like 20 guys. And I mean, by this point in 1994, they had settled down to a more reasonable Dusty Rhodes largely booking the shows, but you figure he would have input from other people, so that would make sense to me.
Well, moving right along to 1995 and Super Brawl 5. What do you got for us, Travis?
I thought it was a really, really bad show overall. The best match was probably I don't know. I liked Hogan Vader. I liked the Sting Randy Savage tag match. You know, just two of the biggest names in the business overcoming two of the fattest guys in the business. The only thing I really
wait a minute. Great trailer's not.
I don't know why it is unfair that I lump him into that. And John Ten is a really, you know, he was a very agile big man too. That's kind of unfair to him. Well, I don't know. This show's undercard though was just so horrible. I don't know who decided. Well, first of all, too, the network version of this show, it's cut off. There were some sort of audio technical problems or something. So it starts off about midway through the opener, the Paul Roma Alex Wright match. The only thing I really wrote down about the show is that the production values, they were so much better than any of the previous four Super Brawls. Just the picture is a little more clear. There's better music. You can hear the ring announcers a little more clearly. But gosh, this undercard, Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Bunkhouse Buck were in something like a 12-minute match. And this was the Kevin Sullivan, Evad Sullivan feud, I guess. All my knowledge of 95 WCW comes from basically the start of Nitro and everything after that. So, again, something I'm not really emotionally invested in, but just some of these matches were just horrible, just horrible.
Yes, I will echo the sentiment of largely horrible matches, but surprisingly enough, I found this an easier show to watch all the way through than 1994, in that, I don't know, it moves at a little bit of a brisker pace. It is, like you said, joined in progress on the network due to, quote, original production technical difficulties. I don't know what those were, but we aren't missing a lot in that Paul Roma, Alex Wright opener. As legend has it, this is sort of where Paul Roma torpedoes his career by trying to get over on Alex Wright, the rookie that WCW was pushing pretty hard at the time. He pretty much won't sell. He cuts off a bunch of Wright's comebacks, totally dominates the match. And it's funny because it makes sense in the context of Alex Wright being this, you know, up and comer and this underdog, but it isn't a lot of fun to watch. And it evidently was not the plan going into this match. So Roma is summarily dismissed after this, and that's kind of the last you see of him. You still have Bobby Heenan on commentary here with Tony Schiavone. Bobby gets pretty tanked during the show, I will say, and about midway through it, that becomes evident because he is slurring his words even worse than myself on our last episode, Andy. I don't know if you noticed that, but I certainly did. Bobby's having a hard time on this show, and it stood out for sure.
Well, I'm just good at editing, so I tried to cut out a lot of your stuff, so I think I cleaned it up pretty well.
I appreciate that. Thank you. But Bobby did not have that same advantage, unfortunately. So it's out there for all the world to see. You know, Sting Savage versus Big Bubba and Avalanche. Like Travis said, it's kind of dumb, but fun. Pretty novel to see Sting and Savage teaming up here for the first time. Savage had only been in WCW for a few months up to this point. So it was sort of like, who's he going to be working with? Who's he going to be teaming with? And sort of begs the question, would you rather see Sting and Savage fighting each other or in a tag team? And this is sort of what they just go with. As far as the main event of Vader versus Hogan, I have no problem with it whatsoever, actually. they made it feel like a really big fucking deal with the whole video package, the interviews and the intros with Michael Buffer in the ring. Vader still looks really strong. He actually gets a visual pin on Hogan, and he kicks out of Hogan's leg drop at one, which is pretty unheard of. Hogan just looks totally desperate here in this match. He has to resort to cheating to gain any sort of advantage. He hits Vader with a chair, like outside the ring. I mean, you've got your typical Hogan shtick at the end of the match, but overall, it wasn't the typical Hogan formula that you had become accustomed to, especially in 1995. And honestly, I'm surprised that Hogan was even willing to work with Vader at all, given Vader's reputation. But I actually really like this main event, to be honest with you. So I'm a little bit higher on the show than I think Travis and most others, but it's not anything that I would say is an all-timer by any stretch at all, but it was an easy enough watch for me.
I was hoping you would say, "Hey, Andy, any thoughts?" And I'd go, "Not talking," kind of like the Macho Man thing. But
yes.
Thanks for not throwing to me.
The Gene Okerlund interview, yeah, where Macho Man refused to give him anything. Yep.
Yeah, so thanks for not throwing to me. But anyways,
sorry, didn't set you up for that.
Yeah.
We can do an edit if you want.
I do have stuff to add to the main event. And you said that you were okay with it. This one actually legitimately pissed me off, but it probably shouldn't, because given that, like, Hogan's always going over, it was like the build was really awesome. Like, they set this up at Starrcade. Then you had the thing where you guys mentioned Vader gave him a powerbomb in a Cosby sweatshirt on a Clash of the Champions. Then yes, they did stuff where I guess they had, like, an hour before. They did kind of like a Sunday Night Heat thing, but it was called the main event, and they did, like, an hour show, like, live on TBS, and then they had matches and, like, angles and stuff, and it kind of set up the pay-per-view. Well, you had Vader come out, and I think he beat up a couple jobbers that were wrestling Stars and Stripes, which was Patriot and Bagwell, and he interrupted that. Then you had stuff with a limo, and he was just, like, Vader was built up to look like a legitimate monster, kind of like how they built him up for the Flair match the previous year. And then Hogan, yeah, he ends up winning, which I think Vader should have won, and they should have done something where Flair, he wanted to get revenge, and, like, you know, maybe they took out Jimmy Hart, so Hogan was vulnerable, and then that's how Vader gets the title or something. But the thing was, is Vader, yeah, was, like, beating the crap out of him, and there was a thing where he even stomped on Hogan's head to get out of, like, an arm lock thing. So it's like the match had some cool spots in it, but I don't know, I just think Vader should have went over.
Well, I guess my attitude was they protected Vader enough, and Vader is not going to beat Hogan here. He's just it's not going to happen. He's not going to get a clean win over Hogan and win the title, because that sort of thing just didn't happen in 1995, and it's just not what Hogan would sign up for. And
maybe I
would agree that it's bullshit, and it would have been the better move, but just realistically speaking of what could have happened and what was going to happen, I think this was the best possible outcome, just because they did at least keep Vader looking strong.
Maybe I'm just looking at the next, like, four or five pay-per-views where it's all Vader Hogan, and it's kind of like they do this match, they do a strap match, they do a tag match, they do a cage match, and it's like you're not going to let Vader at least win once, not even the tag team match. I know.
It does get a little ridiculous. You're right. Yes, absolutely. But just this first match of theirs in isolation, I'm kind of like, oh, I'm fine with. Vader's not going to kill Hogan here and win the title, just because that's not the type of thing that happened back then. It wasn't. As they draw it out and it gets increasingly convoluted, that case becomes a lot stronger for sure. But here, yeah, it's fine.
Well, that wraps up our look back at Super Brawls 1-5 here on Survey Says. We will be back very shortly for part 2, where we look at Super Brawl 6 through the very last installment, Super Brawl Revenge. So for Travis Banks, Tim Capel, and I, we will be back very soon for part number 2. But in the meantime, you can check out past episodes of Survey Says here on the Place to Be Nation, or all the other podcasts part of the Place to Be Nation family on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, online at placetobenation.com, or on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. So stay tuned for part 2 of Survey Says look at Super Brawl here on the Place to Be Nation.